Worth Repeating is made possible thanks to the support from the 80/20 Foundation, the Lifshutz Foundation, and Pasha Mediterranean Grill.
Some of the stories may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to the Worth Repeating podcast. I'm Tori Poole. This is the first part of the live storytelling event recorded at the Irma and Emilio Nicolas Media Center at Texas Public Radio in downtown San Antonio. The theme was red-handed. From little white lies to five-finger discounts, these stories are all about the mistakes and moments that shape you. Can you think of a time when you got caught? Our first storyteller is Stephen Schmidt. Stephen shares a story about getting caught and dealing with the mess afterwards.
So I want to take you back to the summer of 1988. So for those of you old enough to have been around that time, you'll probably remember some of these things. For those of you blessed enough to be too young, trust me, life was really like this. I was one of the original latchkey kids, you know, coming home by myself. And also, I was one that we didn't have social networking, except if you saw enough bikes in the front yard of your friend's house, that's where you knew where to go. And we didn't have cell phones, so we couldn't call to see what time's dinner. But if the lights came on, the street lights came on, we knew it was time to get home. So this summer, my parents had signed us up for swim team practice. So my sister and I would have to go to swim team every day during the week and practice, you know, swimming up and down, back and forth, practice our diving, etc. And then on the weekends, we would have competitions with our neighborhood swim teams. I never quite figured out if our parents signed us up for swim team because of the camaraderie or of the, you know, exercise and healthy living, or to get us out of the house a couple of hours each day. Either way, it was good for all of us. Well, this one particular summer day, my sister and I rode up to the pool, and we were about three quarters of the way there. And I remember it very vividly because I grew up on the northeast side of San Antonio, and the elementary school, there was a path from the elementary school to the pool, and it was a cement path called the Paseo. And my sister and I were riding up there, and we stopped, and she looked at me. And now, my sister's 6 years older than I am, so I was always the annoying baby brother that did whatever my sister asked me to do. And she stops, and she's like, "Do you want to go to swim team practice today?" "Sure." I was like, "Not really, but okay." And she's like, "I don't feel like going to swim team practice today. Should we tell Mom that it was canceled?" I'm like, "Okay." So we turned around, rode back home, and told our mom that swim team practice had been canceled. Now, our mother's a shrewd person. She's an avid reader. She was sitting in her recliner reading a favorite book, and she was on summer break herself because she was a teacher. And as a teacher, she knew all of the kids' tricks. Yeah, you don't try and tell your mom, "I'm sick." No, she knew better. But she trusted us. She thought that we would never lie to her. We're her babies. She raised us from birth. We would not lie to her. So she trusted us to believe that swim team practices had actually been canceled. So she's like, "Okay, no problem." My sister goes off to her room. I hear her radio turn on, and she's listening to music. I go to the room right next to the living room called the playroom, and I was playing Nintendo because I had just gotten a brand new video game and I wanted to get through it. So I'm sitting there about an hour or two later. I'm playing through it, and I hear the phone ring. But I'm focused on my video game. I want to beat this big boss. I think it was Double Dragon was the game. And I wanted to beat this boss really badly. And I hear my mom talking to the person at the other end of the phone, but I don't care. Until I hear my mother ask, "So why was swim team practice canceled?" Oops. So I'm like, I pause the game, still holding the controller, but I pause the game and I'm intently listening, trying to hear who it was she was talking to. And I hear my mother say in a rather exaggerated voice, "Oh, really?" And I was like, "Oh, dear." Put the controller down and I'm just sitting there waiting. Now, my sister is down the hall in her room with her door closed. She has no clue what's going on. So I hear my mother say a few other things, and I hear that sound of the phone being put back into the receiver, and I think I suddenly became religious for a little bit. I was waiting for her to say those three words that no child likes to hear: first, middle, and last name. The only benefit for me was that it wasn't just my name being yelled out. It was also my sister's name. So my mother yells both of our names out. We come walking in. My sister took a lot longer because she was a lot further away. So I'm sitting here taking the glare from my mother. Now, if you've ever met a middle school teacher, you know that they can glare down a football player and they can help a, you know, timid little eighth grader or sixth grader, you know, right off the showroom. They can help them both. But she was giving me that look for a good 5 minutes before my sister came down. I'm just like sitting here like, and waiting. And that glare is one of those that, you know what you did wrong. I'm waiting for you to tell me what you did wrong, because if you try and tell me a lie, you're going to be in even more trouble. So my sister finally makes it in there, and my mother reads us the riot act, and we knew we were in trouble. We were given a choice of punishments. One was either to be grounded for the rest of the summer, which was another 3 or 4 weeks away, and we didn't want that, or to clean out the garage. Now, my father, he is one of many things, but organization is not one of them. His garage was a mess. Now, he could find everything that he needed really easily, but for the rest of us, if we had to find something, it took an act of God. So we decided to take the garage as the punishment. And so we took everything out of that garage. We swept and dusted, cleaned everything away, put it all back, and put it in a way that was organizational to us. We could tell him where everything was. And it was perfect. It was great. We were very proud of ourselves. And so we were all done. And it took us just the one weekend, which surprised our mother, because she was expecting this to take a little bit longer, because she had seen the state of that garage too. So she was very pleased to see how quickly we had got it fixed. And so we, got the garage cleaned up. It was very beautiful, pristine, and everything was, was where it should be. And we kind of showed our dad where things were. We were kind of coaching him along. It's like, okay, if you're looking for this tool, it's going to be over here in the corner. If you're looking for this tool, everything. And it was fine for the first 2 weeks. And then it returned to its previous state of disorganization. But it was his garage, and we weren't planning on lying again anytime soon, so we weren't going to have to worry about it for a while. Come to think of it, my father still hasn't gotten out of that habit, because looking at his garage now, he has a much bigger garage that's open air, and it's still the same state of disorganization. He's joked with us that, when he does finally pass, he's going to tell us where he put the dynamite so we can just light the match and walk away. We'll see what happens. I mean, and I don't know how my mother let that happen, because she was one of the organizational ones. She was a teacher. She knew, always kept things in order, because if you put the papers in the wrong order, things got in trouble. So I'm not sure how they got along, but somehow they made it work. And I kind of got the mix between the two. I can be organized, but I can also be somewhat messy. But of all these things, finding out that you don't lie to your mother, I learned one thing very quickly. If you're going to lie, be the first person to answer the phone call. If you're going to do something that requires cleaning out the garage, if you're going to take a punishment that requires cleaning the garage, wait until the wintertime, because Texas summers are brutal. And finally, no matter how much you feel like, how much you really try, you're going to end up like your parents, for better or for worse. Thank y'all.
This podcast is proudly supported by the 80/20 Foundation, dedicated to creating opportunities through education, community outreach, and meaningful impact. For this and more information, visit 8020foundation.com.
Our next storyteller is Priscilla Reyes. Priscilla shares a story about young mistakes and how they change you.
Hello? Okay. I was just making sure I got it right. Thank you. All right. Okay. Shake it off like Taylor Swift. Shake it off. Okay. All right. I used to be part of a loving home, but one day I find myself on the streets with two hefty bags in my hand and no direction. I was a homeless teenager. I went door to door to all my so-called friends' houses, seeking sanctuary. And eventually, one of my friends let me stay with her in her overcrowded house with barely any food and rations. I slept on the carpet, and I drank herbal tea and the discarded crusts of the sandwiches that the little ones didn't want. I met Monday when life was about survival. I was a cold predator trying to fuck the anger out of me. I treated men like they were faceless chickens. My great-grandmother used to raise chickens for slaughter, and I used to help her feed the chickens. I wanted so desperately to name the chickens, and she discouraged me against it, probably because, you know, she knew it was to come, and so we settled on days of the week. These men were like the faceless chickens from my youth, trying to satisfy a nourishment that was never going to be fulfilled. This wasn't about love. This was about escape. Just like I wanted to escape, Monday Chicken also wanted to be free from his cage. He wanted to be free to love me and to have me for more than just Monday. So against my better judgment, Monday became M, and I became the cage bird. Our relationship quickly escalated, and I moved out of my friend's house and into a home with him. I upgraded from a carpet to a shared queen bed, which was a big deal. And our 3-year relationship, you know, escalated pretty quickly as well. Every time I felt an itch to leave or restless, it's like he knew and he would just tighten the reins on me. And so the first time he did it, he traded our small rental home that we shared with roommates for a home of our own. I should have been happy, but I felt stifled by the purchase, and I resorted back to my predatorial ways. This is how I met Tuesday. He was a coworker of mine. He was my age, which was refreshing because my boyfriend was 5 years older. He was tall with spiky frosted tip hair, a chain wallet, skater shoes, and he listened to pop punk a la Warped Tour. He talked about skateboarding in his free time and the shenanigans him and his friends got into. I envied his ability to act his age. And so like a predator, I stole his innocence for my own. After a couple of weeks, we had a schedule change and I never saw him again. And it really didn't matter because it was Wednesday. Our relationship started to progress, and M said that I didn't have to work. And honestly, the thought of rest and relaxation felt very appealing considering how much I had been struggling. But you can't turn a villain into a princess. He wanted a happily ever after, and I wanted to scorch the earth. This is when I met Wednesday. Wednesday was an ex-boyfriend of mine from back when I was in a loving family, and I wanted my first time to be with someone that I loved. When I was innocent and naive, I saw him at the pool hall hustling for money, and I slowly slithered my way back into his life with quiet conversation, winks, and a perverse plea. It didn't take much to sway Wednesday. He was a complete deviant. He had wall-to-wall bookcases of porno proudly displayed in his living room. We met for afternoons in the park and devoured each other until there was nothing left, and we grew bored of each other. Eventually, I found myself back at that vacant house with a pile of dishes, crappy daytime TV, and just my thoughts to comfort me. I finally begged M to get a job. I manipulated the situation by telling him that I was providing for our future together. And of course, he was enticed because he already bought the house with the white picket fence with the beautiful wisteria that grew everywhere. He just needed the family to fulfill it. So I got a job in retail, and in no time I caught the eye of a man double my age. This is how I met Thursday. He was a stereotypical Mexican man. He was dark skin, pock face, and had black Brillo hair. He had a necklace of the Virgin Mary, starched jeans, button-up shirt, a bolero, and a Stenson hat. He liked Tejano and Norteño music. I wasn't attracted to him at all. But I really liked the idea that he liked me and he gave me gifts. And so we spent long afternoons, lust for me, love for him. He actually believed that I was going to break up with my boyfriend for him, but there was no way I was trading my dreamy Austin home for a double wide on the outskirts of town. So one day I got a promotion at work, and it was accompanied by this beautiful bouquet of flowers. All my friends gushed about what a great boyfriend I had, but the card proved that it was from Thursday. I quickly threw away the flowers and got a hold of Thursday and I broke things off with him. Of course, he was devastated and heartbroken, and I was just annoyed that he got attached. Within a week, Em found out when we were hanging out with friends at the pool hall. They spilled the beans about the flowers, and we didn't talk about it till later that night in the car. He hesitantly asked questions, and I just pounced on his hesitancy with visceral honesty. I told him every sordid detail, everything that happened. I didn't care. I never loved him. He was just a means to an end. And I wanted to hurt him because he knew what I was, and he tried to cage me and control me. At that point, you would think we hurt each other enough and that it should have just ended. But instead, we found ourselves sleeping together with our backs against each other. And I went to bed like a baby. The next night, I was tackling some dishes and he sprung a proposal on me. I felt like I got the wind knocked out of me. I couldn't breathe. And I realized in that moment that I had traded one trapped prison with my family for another. This whole time, he had led me to believe that I was free. But all he had ever did was just give me just enough slack to think that I was. And in that moment, I had to break things off with him. And so I moved all of my stuff into the spare bedroom and tried to figure out an exit strategy. I mean, this whole thing was unplanned, but it was a long time coming. And as I searched for apartments, I searched for men, obviously, and Em had a hard time seeing me move on, and he grew very possessive. And so I lashed out in the only way that I knew how. So this is how I met Friday. Friday was a prospective roommate that he was interviewing. He was like every other guy in Austin trying to make it into the music scene. He had questionable hygiene, long ponytail, wore all black, and had combat boots. He was a songwriter and played bass. He was nothing special in the music capital of the world, but he was the perfect instrument that I could use against M. So I approached him for the suggestion of drinks. We spent the night drinking, chatting, jamming out to music until we found ourselves in the back of his car. This car swayed to the metronome of our bodies slamming into each other. And at the end, we hurriedly put our clothes on and he profusely apologized for what happened. He dropped me off and I stormed into the house like a tornado, and I wiped every chance of reconciliation off of M's mind. I told him what happened, and that night I moved out. For the first time in a long time, I felt free. Like I actually had choices. I felt free like a bird and not a chicken.
This episode is proudly supported by the Lifshutz Foundation, a San Antonio-based charitable foundation committed to strengthening communities through philanthropy and support for meaningful causes. For this and more information, visit directory.tpr.org.
Our next storyteller is Sarah Moore. Sarah shares a story about a normal day at work with a little afternoon delight.
In college, I was a student worker at the Counseling and Assessment Clinic. As a student worker, my job as a receptionist was to make sure that when the clients arrived, that they signed their name on the check-in sheet. In any regular shift, I would see maybe three people. One day, my boss, the lead professor in psychology, asked me to come in on a Saturday because he was going to be out of town and he was expecting a full house. Now, I expected this to be any normal shift, but I don't normally work on Saturdays, so I agreed. Saturday arrived, the first client arrived, and when the client walks in, the door chimes, they walk up to me, they sign their name, and their counselor comes and gets them. Their counselor is a graduate student of psychology pursuing their master's or their doctorate. So when the client gets there, they come and get them. I never have to move from my swivel chair. When they walk in, and the door chimes. To their left, they're going to see a couch. To their right, they're going to see two very uncomfortable chairs, the typical waiting room furniture. A couple hours into my shift, the lab rooms are all full. When they walk in and they sign their name on the check-in sheet, to their right, they're going to see a hallway. Down the hallway, there are three lab rooms flanking the hallway, so there's six rooms total. At the end of that hallway is going to be the office, the back room, where there's an exit to the parking lot, so the counselors can come and go as they please. Behind me at the reception desk is a back office that is usually left unlocked. Now, once all the lab rooms are full, I'm just waiting for something to happen because my job is very cush. All I have to do is make sure they sign in, listen for that door chime. Some counselor comes and gets them like magic every time. So as I'm waiting, the phone rang, but it wasn't the office phone. It was my cell phone. And I look down and I see that it is my darling Daniel, my sexy sniper, calling me from my rack. Now, I know you're thinking, oh, no. But I'm thinking, oh, yes. The last time I saw Daniel, he was about to deploy to Iraq like 8 months prior. And when we met, we exchanged email addresses, not phone numbers. He didn't have a phone, didn't know how he was going to contact me otherwise. So I couldn't think of a reason not to answer because he wasn't supposed to be there. It was a Saturday. He didn't know I was working. I had to answer. So I answer and I say, hello. And we exchange our salutations and our pleasantries. And while this is happening, I decide to take the conversation from my swivel chair to the couch so I can recline and be more comfortable. He is talking about how this deployment is just the worst. The distance is so bad and he misses me. As I sit down, he tells me that the boys have just left. He's all alone. And I hear the sound. I'm entertaining this idea of him being alone. And I hear the sound of sandals slapping between skin and carpet as the substitute, not my boss, the one who's standing in, comes down the hallway. And she looks at me with this intense stare of, what are you doing? And I return that stare of, what do you want? And then we both exchange this as she turns around and goes back down the hall. And I say audibly, what a weird lady. Meanwhile, Daniel hasn't even caught on to the fact that I've been distracted. And he's taken our conversation from sweet to spicy real fast. He's really taken advantage of the boys being gone. And while this is happening, I'm thinking, I'm not just going to let this conversation happen. I'm going to make it happen. So I take a hold of those reins, and I am reliving the highlights. I am laying down the blueprint for future plans. I am talking about my mouth and his cock and his balls and my body. With one ear, I'm hanging on to every delicious word and sound he has to share with me. With the other ear, I am hearing that familiar sound of sandals down the hall. And before I can even react to this noise, I am interrupted by her yelling, you are being broadcast in the back room on the baby monitor. To which I respond as I'm clutching my pearls and grabbing at my clothes like they're about to fly away. What baby monitor? And she says, the one that's underneath the couch. And so I run like she can't see me. And I go to that back office behind my desk and I am crouching down. And I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Meanwhile, Daniel is still going. He is still sharing with me the pleasantries. And I, be quiet. I gotta go, I'm at work. You're at work? And so I slap that flip phone down with some intent. And I wonder, oh my God, what am I going to do? I'm going to lose my job. And I am flushed. And I don't know if it's from the conversation or the fantasy or the reality that is setting in. So I decided to take a deep breath. Like, I'm going to go down that hall and I'm going to apologize. I'm going to own up to what was happening. And I'm going to explain to them, this is love. What they heard was love.
It has been a long and hard deployment, and I am being supportive of my soldier. So I summoned the courage and I walked down the hall. I opened up that back room door, and as I open it, I see that that room is full of about 20 grad students in the middle of a lecture that the substitute is guiding. And as the suspension on the door starts to fail and it is closing in, I am making awkward eye contact with a couple of the students, and I think, nope. And I let that door shut. Then I walk back down the hallway in shame and in silence, in shock. What am I going to do? I sit down at my desk and I wait in silence that is interrupted by one of the grad students who's knocking on my desk. So, who's Daniel? And how serious is this relationship? And I ask him, why is there a baby monitor under the couch anyway? And he explains, it's so we can hear the door chime. And the clients come in. And then upon my reflection, I realize that in a month, I'm going to lose my job. And that is the last time I risked it all in support of our troops abroad.
This episode is proudly sponsored by Pasha Mediterranean Grill, serving up fresh, authentic Mediterranean favorites made with quality ingredients, from flavorful gyros and kebabs to crisp salads and homemade hummus. For this and more information, visit gopasha.com.
Our next storyteller is Elgin Spencer. Elgin shares a story about getting caught at one of the most inopportune times under anesthesia.
So this story takes place on March 6, 2021. At the time, I was a husband, a devoted father, kind of a male whore, retiring now. I was on the way to my second visit from my rental detachment. I kind of got the NyQuil, DayQuil thing going on here. Forrest Whitaker. Along with me was my then wife. She was a Puerto Rican stay-at-home mom, and we have 7 kids together. Yeah. So we get to the hospital visit. And like I said, it's for the second surgery for my rental detachment in my left eye. I'm excited because I'm like, I've been through the first one. This is nothing. We get there. They say, hey, Mrs. Spencer, come dress down. We check in. I put the gown on. I walk out and I'm Winnie the Pooh in because the gown is too small. So then I have to get another gown and like flip it upside down and rip the sleeves. And I had to put it on like pants. And where I tied it, like the tie was right underneath my ass. But the top gown was above my ass, so I had like a gown BBL going on. And yeah, great way to start surgery. So I sat down in the seat. They allowed my then wife to come in. She had all my belongings. And I'm just like, not even thinking about the events that are about to unfold. So anesthesia comes in. They do the IV thing, right? Anybody been under anesthesia before? They put the mask on your face. They say, count down from 10 to 1. Cool. I got to 9. I said, oh, shit. I forgot to delete those apps on my phone. I got to 8. And I was out like a new, like a baby that was just breastfed. I was gone. So I woke up from anesthesia. Groggy. Still loopy, right? There's my ex-wife. Smiles, of course. Like, I'm not thinking nothing happened. Here's the nurse standing right there, slapping me about, trying to get me to wake up. They're joking about us having another kid. Everyone's laughing and giggling. My ex-wife is recording me being silly. And now that I think about it, I think she was recording me to get evidence for the future divorce. So I dress back out. I got clear instructions. I had to keep my head down, just like this, for 8 weeks, right? 50 minutes out the hour for 8 weeks straight. So we're in the car. Now it's an hour and a half ride from North Atlanta to where we lived on the south part of Atlanta. Next thing I know, I hear, "So you still talking to that girl from Laredo, huh?" Now, while I was in surgery, with my eyeball out, so imagine an eyeball in his hand, phone in his hand. My ex-wife is scrolling through my phone because as a trustworthy husband that I was, she had the passwords to everything I had. She was going through my phone and found the apps, the pictures, the messages of my extracurricular activities in Laredo, Texas. So my head is still down, like so, like this. And all I'm hearing is Spanish. Because again, she was a Puerto Rican housewife, 7 kids. So we get home, and if you have a retinal detachment, they make a special chair that you can sit in. It kind of looks like a BDSM chair. Well, like, there's no back, and it's just, like, all front and, like, stirrups. And you can, like, have your head face down like this. Like, so you can, you know, adhere to the doctor's orders. So I go get in my little chair because that was a safe place for me at the time. And she comes in. I think she's mad at this point. And she's like, "You better call that girl right now." And I'm like, "I'm tired. I just had surgery. Like, you want me to do a lot right now? And I'm under stress." And the doctor said, you can always get out of something with the doctor said. So I call her and she picks up. "Hey, how was the surgery? How are you feeling? Are you okay?" Now, the girl I was doing extracurricular activities with was in Laredo, Texas. She was a young Mexican lady, two Latinas that apparently have beef with each other. I don't know where the beef came from. I don't know what year it started, but apparently there's a beef that I found out about that day. So my ex-wife, well, then wife, "I know you're still talking to my husband. Please stop talking to him. He's a married man. You know you're breaking up a family." She's like, "I'm gonna talk to him if I want to." Because apparently young Mexican girls in Laredo have attitudes. But then Puerto Rican housewives with 7 kids have attitudes too. So as I'm painting this picture for y'all, head down again, I'm in my BDSM chair like this. I got a Puerto Rican housewife here. I got a Mexican girl on the phone. I'm hearing huepa and coño on one side. Now I'm hearing ay chingao and Monday on the other. All I know is I was tired because I just had my eyeball out. Remember this eyeball right here. I just had my eyeball out, cut open, and I was under stress. So to relieve some of my stress, I said, "Baby, baby, please stop yelling." And then the girl on the phone says, "I'm sorry." That didn't help. So after my then Puerto Rican wife hangs up the phone, she still has to care for me for 8 weeks after because I can't drive, I can't cook for myself, and she was still a loving wife. Little did I know, though, I got served with divorce papers 6 months later. So the lesson I learned from that was never let your wife gaslight you into going through your phone because that breaks trust, okay? Every relationship should have enough trust to where nobody has to go through your stuff. And that's my story. Thank you.
That's it for the Worth Repeating podcast. Do us a favor and give us a like, subscribe, or review us wherever you stream podcasts. Stay tuned for part two of the live event on the theme Red Handed, now streaming. Worth Repeating returns this fall. Have a theme suggestion? Want to join the storyboard? Maybe help shape the stories that you hear? Perhaps you just want to give us our flowers. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot me an email at worthrepeating@tpr.org. Worth Repeating is made possible by the 80/20 Foundation, Lifshutz Foundation, and Pasha Mediterranean Grill. Worth Repeating is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Tori Poole. Thanks for listening.